Ron Stuckey's parents, sister, family are present among our many other visitors this morning to hear him sing, and we're especially delighted to have them. The advent of every child was made more blessed by the advent of one child whose birth we celebrate in this season. And I hope next week to be able to announce to you another blessed advent. But I will tell you no more than that. I remember one day when I was 9 or 10, looking at a letter my mother had written and finding at the end of it a strange little postscript that I hadn't read yet in a book or heard at school. My mother explained what it meant and pronounced it for me. Noblesse oblige. She was never a student of any foreign language, so someone must have told her about this French maxim, that it can be translated, privilege means responsibility. Noble rank obligates one to behave like a king or a queen. Please remember the definition until we come to a place in the sermon where it makes sense. But first we need a context, a frame to put the picture in, and that's where we start, with a reminder or two from history. We get the idea sometimes that the life of Christ was idyllic in its quiet simplicity, that Palestine was a place of pastoral calm, with sheep nibbling the grass at the edges of little villages and fishing boats rocking lazily on the fresh, clear waters of Lake Galilee. But the truth has another and darker side. Even as a child, Jesus moved in a world of tension and turbulence. Roman soldiers, secretly cursed and openly despised, swaggered along the city streets, bumping peasants out of their way, galling the conquered Jewish people, until at times the humiliation became unbearable. And then, like the rock-throwing Palestinians of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they would hurl themselves against an enemy too strong for them and reap an instant, savage retaliation. We get a faint echo of that tragic time in a report that was brought to Jesus one afternoon. A few days ago, someone told him, there were some people from your own province, some Galileans, who were offering sacrifices to God, and at the very moment when they were worshiping, a detail of Roman soldiers, under orders from Pilate, killed every one of them with the sword. Some of your neighbors watched their blood smoke at the foot of the altar. Tell us what you think about that. He understood perfectly well what the question meant. It was still a popular idea in those days that only wicked people could suffer such terrible things. Suffering, poverty, premature death, these were all proof that one had violated the laws of God. They were punishment from heaven. And even the disciples believed it. One day, when they looked at a man born blind, they asked, with no hint that it could be explained any other way, who sinned, this man or his parents, that this tragedy happened? There was no place in their theology for accident. They would have looked at a woman I know, blinded as a newborn by a careless nurse, and they would have asked, who sinned? This woman or her parents? In other words, there is a moral cause and effect system always at work in the world, and you can explain everything by that system. It's a useful theory, at least to the ones of us who are lucky, because it does two things for us. It relieves us of some of our sympathy, because after all, there's no great need to feel sorry for people who are being punished for their sins. And then because we are doing well, it makes us feel more positive than ever that we must be better than those who suffer. My, my, the disciples think as they look at the poor blind beggar, what did he do wrong? What did his mother and father do wrong to deserve this punishment from God? And Jesus flatly refused to make such a simple reading of life. His answer was, do you imagine that because these people suffered this fate, they must have been greater sinners than anyone else in Galilee? I tell you, they were not. And then, just to be sure they got the message, he brought up another example of disaster, one still fresh in their minds, and one which had happened not in rural Galilee, but in Judea, the sophisticated county, where people considered themselves much more important to God than the farmers up north where Jesus lived. What about those 18 people crushed the other day when the tower collapsed in Jerusalem? What about them? Do you imagine that those men were more guilty than all the other people living in Jerusalem? I tell you, they were not. He refuses to connect their fate with any moral defects. He turns his back on that simple way of interpreting life which solves all the mysteries. And then he says an odd thing which seems out of place as we read the story today, but must have made good sense when it was heard in the context of their whole conversation. No, he said to them sternly, neither in that atrocity you told me about, nor in the accident I told you about, is there any simple cause and effect relationship. But I am going to tell you about one. If you don't change your thinking, all of you are going to perish in the same violent way. What could they have been doing that upset him so much? And the answer is that Israel in those days was like the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are now, an unhappy place full of revolutionaries willing to risk a war to have a free homeland. Some of them had even come to ask Jesus to command the battle, knowing that his charisma would make him a great guerrilla captain. In fact, one of his own inner circle may have been a card-carrying member of this ancient PLO, ready to be a terrorist when the moment came. But among all the other things he was, Jesus was a realist. He knew this would be a hopeless bloodbath with no chance of winning. So instead of an academic debate on why people suffer, he insisted on warning his country about what would happen if she forgot her destiny and went off in directions God had never intended. In that case, all the towers would fall, not just that one. And instead of just 18 people, 100,000 would die because Rome was rapidly running out of patience. So he told them a story, his favorite way of getting inside their heads. And it went like this. Once upon a time, a man had a fig tree growing in his garden, and when he came to look for figs, he found none. So he said to his gardener, "Look, I have come expecting fruit on this fig tree for 3 years running and never found any. I want you to cut the thing down. Why should it take up valuable space any longer?" But the gardener asked a favor. "Master, don't touch it this year until I have had a chance to dig around its roots and give it a bit of fertilizer. Then if it doesn't come through, we can cut it down." The fig tree is pretty clearly a symbol for the small nation of Israel. It had been planted a long time before on a sunny hillside of divine favor, not to be rich or politically powerful or militarily impressive, but to bear the fruit of moral and religious insight, with a special mission to make the ways of God known to all of the earth. At times it had borne that fruit through one of its great prophets, through some season of national nobility, but not lately, Jesus felt as he looked around. Not only had the people forgotten their mission, bearing none of the fruit God intended, but they were taking up space that might be better used in the economy of God by someone else. It was a shockingly unpatriotic thing to say, and dangerous in that volatile country because it smelled like the breath of a traitor. You begin to see why the state hounded this plain-spoken prophet to his death. If he came around today and spoke in such untrimmed language, we wouldn't be comfortable with him either. At the Optimist Club or the Lions Club, someone would say, as someone actually said to me long ago when I was the editor of a newspaper, "Hey, throw away that hammer and buy yourself a horn. Be a booster, not a knocker. If you can't find something nice to say, don't say anything." We are not much in love with people who tell us bluntly what is wrong. But Jesus thought it was time for criticism. God's chosen people had forgotten why they were chosen, and I suppose we can see why they forgot it. Because they had been picked to proclaim the love of God in a world full of hatred, nominated from among the nations to teach that character is the ultimate test of a civilization. What a thankless job. No wonder they had gotten tired of it. And because they were tired, no flowers were blooming on the national tree, no fruit was setting on. The tree was not diseased or misshapen. It was just useless. And above all else, this is a parable about apathy. A stinging rebuke to every one of us. So listen. Whose chief boast is that we never do anybody any harm, as if that were proof of a life worth living. The searching question always is, do you bear the fruit of any active goodness? If not, you're wasting space. Jesus realized that there is a kind of respectability that feels very proud of itself. People in churches and out of them, guilty of no outrageous wrong, never in violation of the law, holding no tainted money, just useless. People who stand around with the call of some great need in their ears and never seem to hear it. People who see injustice but declare as they shut the front door and turn back to the morning paper that it is not their business. It isn't essential to be in a church to do good things. People with no church ties do many splendid things, and they deserve the warmest praise we can give them. But the church was planted on purpose to bear fruit, to help people want to do good things who, without that pressure, might not find the strength to do them. So when we sum up our lives, we aren't meant to spend much time adoring our roots, admiring our branches, loving our leaves. We have an obligation to consider how much fruit we bear. And if this church is like the tree in the parable, then I suppose I could say we pollinate the blossoms, partly the way bees do, by coming to them, by being present. It really does matter whether you are here or not. It matters because it creates a mood, sets a tone, determines whether what we do will seem important. Church members who never come around much except in need of a baptism or a wedding or a funeral say in the plainest of language that at all the other times the church is of no real value. They lower everybody's morale just a little. They make devotion a little harder for the rest of us. I can hear the speaker of this parable say as he looks at a membership list, what are these people doing? What return do they make? So I have to ask myself that question, and I have no choice but to ask you, because you are not just anybody. If the scripture Erica Miller read is to be taken seriously, and if not, why be here at all? If those words from John mean anything, then we are of noble birth, royalty in the kingdom of God. And the nobility is expected to do more than law or custom require. That is, as a matter of fact, exactly what happens in this church. Friday and Saturday were typical. A woman drives her trailer to a Christmas tree farm and brings back this lovely tree and the one for our children downstairs. Another volunteer gets his hair and his luxuriant eyebrows full of pine needles to set them up. Still another woman goes out to buy poinsettias, hang the roping and the wreaths, buy the candles and arrange them in the windows. Hours and hours of work for the rest of us. Three people install the beautiful sconces in the meeting room. Yesterday, I sit for an hour with some busy, talented people who are in another house, giving their valuable time to chart the future of this church. This goes on constantly. And if it did not, mornings like this would not exist. So to all of you of noble birth who work like peasants, with all my heart, I thank you.